My husband tells me that men can't see mess. As far as I can tell, he does appear to have eyes. He also tells me that men are naturally more visual than women, and that's why I need to look a certain way, and why he can't be expected not to stare at women. Seems to me the real goal is to naturalize whatever men want. It doesn't matter what the story we tell is about women and men. It doesn't matter if it's internally consistent or not. It's always about keeping women down. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, as you might guess based on that listener story, we are going to be talking about how bad ideas about women have oppressed women throughout history and continue to be weaponized today. Before we get started, I have my usual administrative reminders. This podcast depends on reader support, which you can offer in the form of heart reacts, positive reviews, and shares on social media. Comments and other engagement also really help boost the podcast visibility by giving these awful social media algorithms what they want. And if you're a super fan, you can become a paid subscriber on Substack or on Patreon. Paid subscribers get at least 8 extra essays a month, plus a bonus podcast episode. They also get access to the private Liberating Motherhood support community. To sign up, visit zahn.substack.com or patreon.com/liberatingmotherhood. I'm here today with my amazing guest, Sarah Rudin. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
I'm so excited to have you here, and I'm going to tell listeners a little bit about you before we get started.
Okay.
Sarah Rudin is a leading translator of the ancient literature of the West. In a career spanning both essential Greek and Roman classics and sacred literature, she has set new standards for accuracy, stylistic integrity, and accessibility. Her work, including cultural and human rights journalism, is deeply concerned with questions of power and truth in accordance with her Quaker faith. She has won Guggenheim, Whiting, and Silver's grants, and numerous other awards. She has a PhD in classical philology from Harvard University. A few of her books include I Am the Arrow, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath, Paul Among the People, The Apostle Reinterpreted and Reimagined in His Own Time, The Face of Water, A Translator on Beauty and Meaning in the Bible, and Other Places, A Book of Poetry. Today, though, we are going to be talking mostly about Sarah's new book, Reproductive Wrongs, A Short History of Bad Ideas About Women. The book is out this week. So, Sarah, I really enjoyed your book, which is saying something because oftentimes these sorts of historical books can feel overwhelming and kind of needlessly dense, but it's so accessible and it's so entertaining. So tell me a little bit about the book, how and why you decided to write it, what you feel it is about, and what you hope it accomplishes.
Thank you so much for your very kind words. The book is my contribution to the fight for women's rights in this very difficult time. And I wrote a book because I really can't do anything else. My skills are verbal to a really ridiculous degree. I'm a verbal and writing person. I seem to have some kind of brain damage. I have practically no sense of direction. I've been lost in my own home. Can't drive. So there are a lot of practical things I can't do. So I went for what I thought would be very safe for me in the way of education and career. I started French at 14, Latin at 16. German and Greek at 18, and just kind of kept on going. I did classics, a PhD at Harvard University, starting at the age of 21, and I expected to be just spending my life in libraries. But I had a very interesting time after I got my PhD. There was the usual tight job market for classicists, and a job came up right at the end of apartheid at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. So I went down there, I did a phone interview, went down there sight unseen, and I stayed for 10 years. And so that was my political awakening. I love South Africa. I got conscientized, as feminists of an earlier generation would say, and got woke up to all of the problems of the developing world. And then I came back here 2000 and 2005. Not sure, what I could do, except write books. So I started. I had already published three, so I more rapidly published some books. And again, I was working in my little area of language, but I found a way to politicize that because I began looking at sacred literature and asking, well, what does it really mean? What does this word really mean? And I got to translating, or retranslating the Bible and other sacred literature with a view to unearthing where our notions come from, where our political culture comes from. And of course, I encountered pretty quickly how distorted it was, particularly in the interests of men, in the interests of anti-Semitism, and in the interest of authoritarianism generally. So, yeah, I'm bumping along on this route. And then the crisis of this is a very long background. I'm sorry,
This
but
no, this is great.
I'm getting to the point here. Then Donald Trump happens, and I thought about where these crazy ideas about reproductive rights come from. How on earth do people get these, insane notions that they have? And I knew that there were a couple of anti-abortion poems by Ovid, who's a first century BC poet, early AD as well, in the court of Augustus, the first Roman emperor, who was the first real modern Western authoritarian. So, right out of the blue, anti-abortion propaganda springs up when authoritarianism is on the rise in the West. Okay, you'd had these god kingships of the Near East. Fine, they were pretty fragile. They didn't really last, but there was something kind of clingy about the authoritarianism that the Romans founded. And Christian authoritarianism springs out of that almost directly. And so you get this series of propaganda gambits against women's reproductive freedom, and that is freedom going both ways, freedom not to have children, freedom to have children. There was a cult of celibacy, which condemned women and their whole domestic role, their whole reproductive role. Well, reproductive role was the only thing that they had left, and it was very, very restricted and controlled. Yeah, and this goes on, straight up to today when you have very, very weird anti-abortion propaganda. So, here I was writing a book about it, and I was lucky to find a wonderful publisher in Norton Liverite, and they shepherded this book through. It was a bit difficult to conceive, to execute, because I was doing something that really hadn't been done before, which was examine a whole social history through a really limited number of documents. So I had to pick out the documents that were most important, figure out what was most important about them, and do this by example. And, I encountered a lot of really weird authors. But the thing was, these were really authoritative authors. These were classic authors like Augustine, who was really the father of Catholic Christianity. Charles Dickens, of course, needs no introduction, but he was very, very important in his attitude toward very large families, toward adoption. Yeah, and on it goes. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun with the book. I'm having a lot of fun sharing it. Just very excited. And for me, I want my contribution to be that people think more comprehensively about what people are saying to them, that people can understand where these ideas come from, and what they are trying to achieve. Because we are going to be acting out these ideas if we don't understand and combat them better.
That's a huge contribution. And I think your book is really successful at doing that. So the thing that I like about this book specifically, but kind of the thread I see in your work more broadly is we, and especially men, have this idea of history as this like set of facts, and it's the set of facts that you have to memorize, and there's like only one correct view. And that's not actually how it works. So while I was reading your book, I was thinking about this really unfortunate research that I had to do last year for an article I was writing that required me to read part of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. So I'm going to tell you a story about this and then I'll explain why I'm sharing this. So the book starts with this like absolutely horrific story of the author just brutally emotionally abusing his wife as she recovers from giving birth and from severe childbirth injuries. You know, he goes back to work early, he leaves her alone without pain medication or help, and then he screams at her for seeking help. So he tells this story about himself at the beginning of the book. And then his explanation for why all of this transpired is just, well, you know, women are more emotional than men, and men are more rational. And if both parties just understood this, it would somehow fix things, and somehow his abuse is a sign of his rationality. So, like, this book sold millions of copies, and so clearly lots of people accepted the author's version of events. But to me, the opening narrative is just transparently a story of an abusive man, like, justifying his abuse. So, I bring this up again because the lens through which we see stories is so important. You know, and we focus a lot on history with like getting the facts as if there's one set of facts, but what the facts are shift depending on who tells the story. And critically, for our most honored texts, it shifts with who is the translator. So I would love it if you could talk to me a bit about that because I love how your book focuses not just on what's happening to women, but why it's happening and how it upholds larger systems of power rather than just kind of like reciting long lists of things that happened.
Right. Yeah. Well, shall I talk to you a little bit about my work as a translator of the Gospels? I have
I'd
my own.
love to hear it because, you know, for me, I mean, I am like, I was raised Catholic and I was raised kind of like a progressive questioning Catholic. And I grew up very frustrated that I was having to read these translated texts that I could not translate back to their original and just had to accept what was in them. And I love it that maybe you have kind of a different offering there.
Right. Yeah, no, it's absolutely remarkable how much the canonical translations of scripture repress women's point of view and repress women's communication. One of my favorite stories in the gospel is the story of Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. So she's Canaanite, she's a pagan. She lives on the coast of Judea. And so she is untouchable to Jews on several counts, religion, ethnicity, gender. But Jesus encounters her when he visits her city, and she throws herself at him. She's grabbing her knee, his knees. She's a suppliant in one version, or both, I forget. She wants a healing for her daughter, sight unseen. And in a standard translation, Jesus calls her and her people dogs. And he says, you know, the dogs don't, the bread is for the children of Israel, and we don't share that with dogs. Now, in actual Greek, and I've never found an accurate translation of it, in any canonical version, kunaria, the Greek word kunaria, is translated simply as dogs. So, especially from a Judaic perspective, that's a horrible insult. Dogs are filthy. Dogs are useless. Dogs mate in the street. You don't have pet dogs. This is the sort of Middle Eastern Semitic, version of the dogs. They don't use them in herding, or as pets, so they are outcast. But the Greek version, okay, which is written by someone whose cultural basis is Europe, uses the word kunaria, which means little doggy. So it's a cute comic word. It's not, doesn't mean puppies, but it seems to mean lap dog, cute little dog, or it's an endearment for a dog. Oh, you little canarian, oh, you little cute little thing. So that's the word that's put in Jesus's mouth in Greek. Okay, yeah. So he's not speaking Greek, because he's speaking Aramaic. That's his native language. But we get this text that goes a very long way to soften the tradition of what he said to this woman. So this is very early Christianity. Women are participating very vigorously, outspokenly. They're treated more as equals in Christianity than they have been, until the 20th century. So the author takes great pains to soften this. So Jesus calls her people cute little doggies, not dogs. And she responds by saying, yeah, well, even the little doggies, get the scraps under the table, which is a comic, that's a comic trope in Greek and Latin literature. That during a feast, the dogs eat till they bloat, they lie on their backs groaning. So that comic trope is adapted here in the story. And then Jesus is shown answering, all right, yeah, because that was a good one, sort of rough translation of what he says. Yeah, that's a good one. So I'm healing your daughter. And so he gives the daughter long distance healing, and the woman goes back and the daughter's fine. So yeah, often the later version, and we're talking about early modern translations when we talk about English translations of the Bible, so we come clear up to the Renaissance when we start getting the important translations, the influential ones. Those are often more bigoted than the original ancient ones, because the text and the thought has gone through the medieval period, the late antique period, and the medieval period, when Christian misogyny has become absolutely ravenous, and when it's gone completely insane, when women become the gate to hell. When women are not good company, when you wouldn't even speak to a woman, this is privately and formally. So the church fathers have established this in late antiquity, and later Christians just run with it. It doesn't start coming apart really until the Age of Enlightenment. Yeah, so I've got this fire in the belly to look at the text for myself in the original language, to translate them very, very carefully, and just try to get a sense of the mood, the thoughts, the social context of the author, and fit that in or not fit that in to the history of ideas. And to look critically then at what ideas we are getting. We just get them, and we get them often in ritual form. They're part of the liturgy. So these are holy, these are part of prayers and rituals. So we're not supposed to question them. We're supposed to just absorb them. But that's a bit crazy, if you could just see, for example, the original language of the Ten Commandments. It's not commandments at all. It's the Hebrew word means matters, and that can be matters for discussion. There's another word if you want to say commands in Hebrew. There are certain ways to say that very, very clearly. That's not what's said in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are more, they're more like prose. They're more like they keep trailing off into discussion of the relationship between God and human beings, and between human beings of different kinds, strangers, our own community, foreigners, servants, and so on, even animals. My drive is to dig into this stuff and to understand it better, and to bring it to the politics of today and say, well, look what we've been taught to believe, look what's been pounded into our heads, and look again at the mindset of the people who wrote it. In some cases, they're more open-minded than we are.
Well, so you talk a bit in the book, but you've also spoken here about how, a lot of the Christians who were propagating this ideology and translating early versions of the Bible, they seem to have a lot in common with like Andrew Tate incels and like red pill sorts of people. And I'm really struck by that, how those ideologies of women as objects who are not interesting to have relationships with, who are not people you want to associate with, keeps cropping back up throughout history. And that the people who endorse that ideology are maybe the people who are giving us our sacred texts.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've found, actual sacred literature generally better than the secular literature when it comes to women, particularly the Gospels, and particularly Paul. Translators have not served them well at all. But when you go out into, say, secular literature, or pagan literature, which is, both secular and sacred at the same time, that's where you get the really poisonous, and the church fathers, of course, semi-sacred literature. That's where you get the really poisonous ideas about women, and as you say, they coordinate so horribly, so creepily with the same stuff that we're being told today. Now, Ovid, okay, he's in the late first century BC, and he pulls this idea out of his ass. We don't know where else he got it, but he decides that abortion is the worst crime in the history of the world. Abortion is equivalent to genocide. It's a potential genocide every time a courtesan, has an abortion. And he says, abortion is a threat to the whole sacred history of the world, which is centered on Rome and its empire. So if these women of myth and legend had had abortions after they were raped by gods or had affairs with gods and got pregnant, and they were destined to give birth to the heroes who would champion Rome or found Rome. Then if these women had committed abortion, if these women had committed the crime of abortion, then they would have snuffed out the providential history of the world. The world is destined by the gods to be governed by Rome, but if women had refused, for example, if the princess Ilia had refused to give birth to the twins who founded Rome after she was raped by a god, then we wouldn't have Rome and the world would be just falling into nothingness because Rome is what holds the world together. So, and there's a parallel story that's told by the anti-abortion movement. Okay, Mary, she must have thought about getting an abortion. What an inconvenient, embarrassing pregnancy for her. Why didn't she just get rid of it? Well, because of divine providence. And had she gotten rid of it, we wouldn't have Christ. The world would not be saved. You know, we would all be going to hell for our sins. And there's, I don't think there's a causal relationship between, these two, between Ovid and between, you know, this and modern anti-abortion propaganda. It's just that this is kind of the thing that bubbles up when men think defensively about women's reproductive freedom.
Well, so I have this theory, and you may or may not agree with me. It's sort of irrelevant. But that the sort of origin of patriarchy is men's desire to control women's reproductive labor, and perhaps both their desire to control the means of production, women, and also perhaps fear and envy of what women could do that they couldn't. And I think that we really see that in this abortion rhetoric. So while there may not be a causal relation, we definitely see this idea just injected into the culture for thousands of years that, like, the really, really, really bad thing is women controlling their uteruses. Why are they so obsessed with this?
Well, I think it does have something to do with the cult of celibacy, where the point in which, you know, anti-choice propaganda gets worse and worse and worse over the centuries, and where it gets really, really bad, or starts to get really, really bad, so that women making reproductive choices are demonized. They are the ultimate evil. They should be tracked down, tortured, killed, burned to death. That's during the witch hunts, right at the dawn of the early modern period. So this is the late 15th century. The Renaissance not quite yet started. Depends on, you know, how you date the Renaissance. Anyway, there's a celibate monk, Heinrich Kramer, who writes the definitive handbook for persecuting witches. And he has a visceral, deeply, deeply rooted hatred of women. And, you know, like you said, this would be connected to his desire to control women, to punish women, and it's a heightened emotion in his case because he's a celibate monk, so he's forbidden from touching women. You know, household is you know completely out of his sphere. He can't control women, and he apparently tries to through convents, and he seems, you know, from what's been handed down to us about him, he seems to have been either a rapist or a sexual harasser of nuns because he was banned. At one point, he was banned from convents, which is really, really extreme. For them to have taken that step, against a male cleric or male religious was re really, really extreme because it was always assumed that, the priest will need to go, into this convent because they can't have mass otherwise. But he was banned. He, then, comes up with this idea or strengthens it. We're not sure whether, this is originally his idea. But his idea that he pounds in this handbook of his is that women are the destruction of the entire universe because not only are they aborting and killing mortal babies and dedicated them to Satan, they are also mating with demons, and that's breeding Satan's army. So the implication of this is that when we have the apocalypse, the human army is going to be too small and will lose to the demons.
I mean,
Yes, this is really the idea. So talk about imperialism. Talk about wild, supernatural distortions of the imperialist idea. Our women need to beef up our armies, so they need to breed up a storm, or we're going to be flushed down the historical toilet, overrun by our enemies. No, we are going to be overrun by supernatural enemies because Heinrich Kramer's hatred of women has reached supernatural proportions.
I mean, it's just truly unhinged. But okay, I want to read something that you sent me that I think is on this point, and it's amazing. So we were talking via email about sort of the history of anti-abortion propaganda, the history of men's efforts to control what women do with their bodies. And you sort of summed up your entire book with this paragraph, and here's what you said. Ovid. Women could kill world-saving Rome if they wanted to, the early Christians. Women kill men's souls and endanger the coming of God's kingdom with their silly, distracting demands for partnership with men and authority within the home. God, that sounds familiar. The witch hunters. Women kill God's army in the womb and in the cradle. The Victorians and the 1950s American housewife cult. Women will kill the home and drive men to barbarism if they don't marry early and have lots of children. The present day anti-abortion movement. Women kill American competitiveness, holiness, and the white future. And it's just, you sum it up so well. And you talk a lot about, the right focusing on themes of genocide with abortion. There seems to have always been this notion of women as genocidal maniacs or maybe aspiring genocidal maniacs, particularly at times where men are committing actual genocide. And it's just so obviously false that women are the real threats to society, family, children, the home, whatever. It's men. But why is it so easy for these false ideas of women as the really dangerous ones to catch on? Is it just that we have so much propaganda that we fertilize the soil with?
Well, men are have been, up to a couple of centuries ago, men were almost the exclusive authors. Even when women were literate, they couldn't publish. So men have the exclusive capacity to spread these ideas around, and women have not been able to counter them. Not until now. You're absolutely right about men foisting their own aggression and their own crimes onto women through words. Men are imputing to women their violence and their injustice and their arbitrariness. And this actually becomes substantive, a substantive excuse for genocide. And that's I think of the situation that's developing right now. You know, we've got a situation in the United States where we could have a real femicide because the rule of law, as far as women's reproduction goes, is breaking down very rapidly in the red states. You have what could develop into a reign of terror against pregnant women. You know, focused, of course, on women of color and poor women, women who can't fight back. And the justification for this is genocide. So you read the propaganda of the American anti-abortion movement, and all over the place, genocide, 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 genocide. You know, tons of comparisons of, you know, the very ordinary, very conscientious, very well-run system of American reproductive medicine, or it was that until a few years ago. And, you know, that's compared to the Holocaust. Absolutely shamelessly compared, you know, to the extermination of 6 million Jews.
Okay, I really want to emphasize what you said about how accusing people of genocide is often a justification for genocide. Because in my work with abuse women, what we often tell them is every allegation is a confession. You know, they accuse you of what they are doing or what they're going to do because abusers always believe that their abuse is justified. They always have to other the victim and assert that the victim has done something to warrant the abuse. And I think that this is so clear on a mass scale in your book and in your work that we have this individual phenomenon with abusive men, but we also have this collective phenomenon of every allegation is a confession. We accuse women of engaging in genocide so that we can engage in femicide and so that we can engage in mass genocide against anybody we have othered.
Right. Yes. I think that is absolutely true. And, you know, that's psychological paradigm, you know, when it expands to a whole, you know, political system, it becomes incredibly destructive. It becomes world destabilizing because the anti-abortion movement latches on to the Holocaust and World War II for a reason. And that reason is that genocide is a worldwide emergency, especially when it's connected to a world war like World War II. So the Allies during World War II fought, and most people would say justifiably, an all-out war against fascism. They bombed German cities to ashes. They dropped a nuclear bomb on Japan, two nuclear bombs, and got away with it because this was an emergency. The fascist genocidal forces, you know, were, you know, set to destabilize, destroy the planet. So you arguably had to act with extreme measures. And Britain, especially, and the United States killed a lot of civilians in the a lot of innocent people, you know, in their pushback. So the anti-abortion movement loves the example of the Holocaust, because of the extreme violence that was needed to push back against it. So their reasoning is, it's an emergency. Yeah, we're gonna have innocent victims, and yeah, that's really too bad. And we don't mean it. We're not cruel. We're not destructive. We don't hate women. We're not out to control women to a fantastic degree. We just need to do this to save our society from utter destruction. And you'll see versions all over anti-abortion propaganda of today. You will see this more or less spelled out.
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, I see it anytime I post any of my work on social media, particularly about male violence, or the thing that really sets them off is if I say something like, the biggest statistical threat to a woman is the man she lives with. And they're on about genocide like before you can even finish the sentence. And it's like they all go to a school where they get these scripts. They're like robots repeating this stuff. It's wild to me.
Well, the anti-abortion movement is incredibly organized. It is deeply rooted. It has its own education system. There are, universities which, as one of their priorities, will train people. Brainwash them. I'm going to use that word, brainwash them, under the guise of ordinary degree programs, ordinary professional programs. They will brainwash them with anti-abortion propaganda. So this has been done for well, ever since Roe v. Wade. And these institutions have been built up very, very carefully. They have periodical publications. They have conferences. They it's all the background to this stuff is pretty discreet. But yeah, you can find it. And when you read the Frank version, you read what these people are saying to themselves, in publishing in documents that are read only internally. It's extra horrifying because none of the excuses that are given in public, none of the moderate talk, none of the false promises are bothered with in this environment. You just say what you think about the rest of America and what you plan to do to them. And
Absolutely.
it is truly horrifying.
Well, I will tell you, I went to Catholic schools and I went to a Catholic college because my goal was to just go to whatever place gave me the biggest scholarship. So I did all this in spite of being raised by very progressive parents and being, pro-choice like from the cradle. And it is astounding to me in hindsight the amount of energy these schools spent on abortion. All of our religion and philosophy and ethics classes were about abortion. And you're right, there would be the public-facing talking points, and then there would be the internal talking points. And it's true brainwashing because I even found, again, as a progressive child and then a progressive college student who was very pro-choice, they didn't change my mind, but they started to make me frame abortion as something that was like distasteful, at least. And so if they can kind of do that to me, I mean, I obviously don't feel that way anymore, but if they can do that to me, they can do that to anybody. It gets in there very deep and they start very young.
Right. Yeah. This is, really, really interesting to hear about from you about, because this is something that I don't know about. I was raised United Methodist by pretty liberal parents. So I don't have any sense of how the education system works, from early on. Yeah, I believe you when you tell me this, because I was sort of dealing as a frequent visitor with evangelicals and with Catholics at their institutions, and I also wrote for one of their journals on cultural matters and got close to an editor, and wrote for Catholic magazines as well. I tended to find a lot of open-mindedness on other topics, even on topics that are supposed to be quite controversial, such as gay rights. And I was able to tell my evangelical editor at a banquet surrounded by Catholic and evangelical people, very conservative. I was able to tell him right out loud, don't bother. Tell your friends not to bother offering me a teaching job, because I will not, sign their ideological pledge, because my agent is openly gay and he's a good and decent person, and I will not entertain the idea that he's going to burn in hell because of who he loves. So I said that, and he accepted it. And I did find, in many other environments, that there was a degree of tolerance toward gay people. There was theological tolerance too. As a Quaker, I could say, well, I don't believe in hell at all. And they would say, yes, fine, we're kind of sympathetic to that, and we're evolving too. And you'd get all of this, and they would mean it as well. They would be accepting of these views if they came up among their own parishioners or their own fellow congregants. It was fine. And their institutions were slowly evolving as well. I write about this in the book. But you say the word abortion or reproductive rights, and there's an immediate shutdown.
Oh, it's
It's
unreal.
unbelievable. Yes, they're absolutist. They are absolutist about this. They will not discuss it, and the absolutism goes to surprising directions. Their absolutism extends surprisingly far in their political goals. So I've been reading that, a whole large group of academics, who get together to discuss strategy for the anti-choice movement, want all contraception to be illegal, even condoms.
Oh yeah, they call them abortifacients. Condoms, they say, you're interfering with the possibility of pregnancy and therefore undermining God's will. It's like, well, they don't say that about antibiotics. It's just so clearly skewed towards keeping and getting women pregnant. And so I'll tell you, I had they Catholics are so strange about this. That even when you get kind of like abortion adjacent, it's like, I don't want to say they can't think because that sounds too dismissive. There's this intense, visceral, emotional reaction. So as someone who did, 12 years of hard time in Catholic school, I have a ton of Catholic friends and a lot who are still practicing. And we our second child, we lost our second child. And but we found out this was going to happen when I was pregnant with her because, they can do all kinds of testing and all of this. And I remember like sharing with friends and sharing on Facebook, we've gotten this terminal diagnosis. We're trying to figure out what to do, that sort of thing. And my friends who were Catholic were so unable to see anything other than they had to make sure I didn't have an abortion. And so, we got tons of messages of, well, doctors are always wrong. And, doctors try to convince you to have abortions. And I'm sure if you just pray enough, it'll be okay. And it was shocking because like these are the people who are supposed to value life. So these are the people who are supposed to, come in and be like, oh, this is so awful. How can we support you? But they're just totally have blinders on for the anti-abortion stuff. Because we start with them when they're like 3, 4, and 5 years old, and so they just can't see anything else.
Oh, well, the really scary thing about this to me is brainwashing that's effective to that extent, does spread, and it does, for example, kind of reach out to the anti-vax people and coalesce with the anti-vax movement. So, there was one paper I read given at one of these conferences, that was it was this was during COVID, and the anti-abortion activist, an academic who gives this paper, decides to rip into the, vaccine provision for COVID, because tissue from aborted fetuses was apparently embryonic tissue was used. Some of this was tissue from discarded embryos from fertility clinics. So he had this whole plan, political and legal, for throwing a Molotov cocktail into the research for the vaccine and into vaccine provision, should the vaccine be developed. So I'm not quite sure at what point, in a vaccine provision he came in here, but he had a whole sort of horrifying scheme, which would have gotten a lot of people killed. Had to do with refusing the vaccine and also refusing quarantine.
That's I was thinking about this a lot when I was reading your book with, there's the anti-vaccine stuff because it's aborted fetal cells. And so there's what I and you and probably most of the listeners think of as morality. So morality is things like we don't spread diseases to people. We support our friend whose baby is dying. We don't abuse women. These are all the things that we take for granted. But then this sort of propagandized religious morality comes in and like cannibalizes actual ethics that actually improve human life. And the thing that this reminds me of in your book is you talk about Saint Augustine. And as a recovering Catholic and as a philosophy major, I've read enough Augustine to just permanently like destroy my brain. But the story that I have been told about Augustine is very different from the story that you tell. And the story that I have been told is that he was this like hedonistic monster who was, having all this debauched sex and he was just a bad guy. And then he found God and glory be, Hosanna in the high, he became a saint. The story you tell is so much more compelling. It's that he was this like loving partner and father. And then he found God and he abandoned that. And this to me is an example of the like propaganda morality cannibalizing the real morality. It seems like finding God made him a worse person.
Right. Yeah. Well, the actual, the lies, the propaganda lies told, about all these authors are just kind of astonishing. It's not too hard. I'm a translator of Augustine. I translated the Confessions, so I had to go into his life and his thought to some degree, read up on him as background. And it's perfectly factual, easy to learn, that he had maybe a short time of running around, and that included some homosexual experimentation. It was probably less than a year. It was very, very ordinary for Roman students at the time. Probably nearly all of them, sowed more wild oats than he did. But he wasn't, he simply wasn't like that. He felt very guilty about it, even at the time. And then he latched on to a woman that he really loved. He was devoted to her, but much more devoted to her, their child, the child that they had together. And so, yeah, his getting religion was, as you say, it was a disruption of his faithfulness and, his really high quality performance as a family man. He took this woman with him to Italy. He was devoted to educating his child the same or even more so than if the child had been legitimate. He had big plans for the child. It broke his heart, and almost shattered his religion when the child died. Yeah, we got to think of him as a broken family man and broken by religion, rather than a, skirt chaser tamed by religion.
I mean, we see this. I feel like I see this a lot in, readers email me constantly with their problems. And one of the most common themes that I see is that they had an okay marriage, or at least not an abusive one. And then the husband finds religion and finds God, and he just becomes an absolute fucking monster. Like, it's wild to me.
Right. Yeah. It's as if the religion becomes a license.
Yes, I think it is. I think it does.
Yeah. And one of the most disturbing things that I see in anti-abortion propaganda of today is this Dietrich Bonhoeffer story. I don't know whether you've come across it. Okay, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he's a Protestant clergyman. He's opposed to the Nazis. He flees to America for a while, then he goes back, and he gets involved in a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. They don't really think very deeply about what it would mean if they succeed. And what it would mean if they fail, and they failed, and failing was probably worse than succeeding. They cut out this little bit of the Bonhoeffer story, and that little bit is that he agonizes, and he's a pacifist, and he doesn't believe in murder. So how can he sign on to this assassination? And his reasoning is that National Socialism is an absolute evil embodied in Hitler. So you can kill Hitler for the greater good.
Right.
So what's extracted from the reasoning is we can commit murder for the greater good. We can even commit murder for the greater good. And so it's not that the anti-abortion movement says in public, oh yes, oh horribly unfortunate, that some women are dying of miscarriages for care, lack of the care that's denied them in emergency rooms. This is just a misunderstanding, and it's the fault of, the pro-choice movement, for the pro-abortion movement, it's their fault, and this is just a mix-up, and we're going to straighten this out. But the real reasoning, behind these deaths and the acceptance of them, and the crackdown, the worse and worse measures that are going to lead to more and more deaths, is that they have reasoned it out that it's acceptable for them to cause death. Because in the cause of saving innumerable babies, in the
Oh
cause
yeah.
of preventing a Holocaust,
Well,
they
their framing is it's you're killing, one or five or 10 or 100 women, and you're saving, thousands of babies. And I don't think they're even like that. I don't think they're that secretive or shameful about it. They uphold when I was, probably 10, they were teaching us about Gianna Mola, who's this Catholic saint from the 1940s. Who was canonized because her fourth pregnancy threatened her life. And rather than have an abortion, she chose to die and leave her child without a mother and give birth. And so the message clearly there is that the life of the child trumps the life of the mother.
But you can tell what the actual calculation is and what the actual sentiment is behind this rhetoric, because in a situation like this one, and probably also in the past situation when abortion was legal, up to Roe v. Wade, or legal in a lot of the country, was that you weren't preventing abortions. You
Right.
weren't saving babies. You were, the back alley abortions would endanger the life of the mother, often kill the mother, and of course, the fetus would perish too. So you had all of that going on, and then you had large number of women traveling to have abortions. Right now, you have medication abortions, which are still, widely available in red states through telehealth. So you have this huge, campaign that's very costly in women's lives and in welfare of women and families, might lead to a civil war, because of political destabilization, because women are not going to accept the degree of control and punishment that they're in for. So you have, if you do all the calculations correctly, you have no net savings of fetuses' lives.
Well, I can tell you that we don't. There was a study that came out, I think it was 2017. I'll find it, I'll send it to you, and I'll also put it in the show notes, that compared countries with restrictive abortion laws and countries where abortion was completely banned to countries with liberal abortion laws. And what they found is that the countries with the most restrictive abortion laws had the highest rate of abortion because the laws didn't stop abortion. Instead, what they did is they created these miserable conditions that led to even more abortions. You know, you had second and third and fourth generation abortions of children raised in poverty and in terrible circumstances. So it's not actually about abortion. It never has been, or it's never been about ending abortion. I'll say that.
Right. Yeah. The pro-choice activists are absolutely right. It's about punishing women. It's about controlling and punishing women.
And it always has been in one way or the other, as your book shows. So I'll ask you, I have one final question for you in this moment of immense historical darkness. I kind of delayed reading your book for a while after I got it because I was like, it's just going to make me upset to think about all these things that have happened to all these women. And there is a lot of darkness in it, but it's a darkness that kind of offers hope because it weaves this thread through all of history and shows that like things are always changing because we change them. And I liked how your book made me feel connected to like historical figures as real people. And so even though there's like all this darkness in it, it did close making me feel hopeful. So here's my question to you. How do you look at all this misery? How do you write about all these mis this misery and still sustain hope to keep pressing on?
Well, you gotta somehow have a sense of humor about it. And you can make that a really angry sense of humor. That's fine. That'll work. I heard something wonderful on YouTube today. The Danish foreign minister directed at Donald Trump and MAGA America words that he said they would understand, which were fuck off.
I mean, that's simple to the point.
Simple to the point. As far as Gringa goes, here's language that you understand. Fuck off.
I love it.
The time has passed when we try to keep having discussion with people we know will never have it with us. The time has passed when we tie ourselves in knots trying to be polite and constructive. The time has come to fight. And for those of us, who are committed pacifists, who do not fight in a bodily sense, we have to fight with what we have. And that's with our language and that's with our truth.
I think
And
that's a beautiful message. I love that. And you know, when you were opening the podcast and talking about why you wrote this book and why you write books generally, you said it's because it's what I can do. And that's all anyone can do is what they can do.
Right. And when you do what you can, your mood lifts, your heart lifts, and you meet people who are of your mind and people who are sympathetic, and people who are fighting with you, each person in his or her own way. And then you really feel hope. But it's the time certainly has passed when we can lie to ourselves about what is going on. We have to face head on what we are dealing with, what we're going to be dealing with for a long time now.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to end it on. Sarah, thank you so much. It has been such a gift to have you on the podcast. I hope everyone goes out and buys your book. It's going to be out this week and it's really remarkable. I'll put all of Sarah's information in the show notes and I will be back next week with Soraya Shamali. Sarah, just thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. This has been lovely.